First, in the 1990s, as a civil rights attorney, you went to war, as you put it, to war with the LAPD. And, of course, you won a bunch of police brutality cases against the LAPD. What was it like back then? How bad was it?
Oh, back then, it was a pitched battle every day. And it was high intensity, high adrenaline, high drama. And every day gave us a chance to get our weapons out and try and bash each other. And we spent a very, very long time doing that. I put most of the blame on LAPD because they wouldn't talk to anybody, and they also wouldn't heed anybody's requests for more humane treatment. And really all we were asking for was, please don't humiliate us. Please don't pull us over for no reason. Please don't beat us up for no reason. And LAPD was so brutal and so gang-like back in those days that they couldn't stop themselves from doing all of those things over and over and over again in the black community, mainly in the black community.
You know, I was struck because you're saying back then. I don't know. That's not that long. That's not that long ago. And you gave a story. I think it was in your book, where you were talking about the death squads that were organized by the LAPD. I felt like I was reading something about Honduras.
Yes, I felt like I was in Honduras or Guatemala or Mexico back in those days. Those horrible old days. It was frightening because what we had were cells of officers who were outlaws. They did not represent the average cop. The average cop would pull somebody over for no good reason, but the average cop did not do curbside executions. But we had a handful of cops, I called them hunter-killer cops, who lived to kill. And they were executing people left and right. It was kind of terrifying because, and the reason that we know they exist is because the good cops would pick up the phone and warn us that the hunter killers had targeted us, meaning the lawyers.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, I had a call one time from a cop in the Southeast Division who found they would always call me from those telephone booths. I know people don't remember those. But they would find a telephone booth, and they would put the coins in, and they would call my office. And they would say, Miss Rice, don't come down to Watts tonight. Graveyard is hunting for you. Wow. That's how I knew. The good cops, and this is what taught me that there were good cops and bad cops, the good cops would always try to warn me, and they would often try to protect me. And that's how I knew of the existence of the hunter killers. Now, I ignored them, of course, and went down to Watts anyway. But what that taught me was that the good cops were afraid of the bad cops. And it also showed me that fighting all cops was not the strategy, that you had to get behind the good cops. What we really needed to do was to put the good cops in charge so we'd have constitutional policing and move the bad cops out of policing altogether. That's what showed me the way.
And that's what you did. In some sense, you're not at war with the LAPD anymore, are you? You work with the LAPD, right?
Well, we moved to put the good cops in charge, and I decided a long time ago that the only way to get cops who police constitutionally and humanely was to empower the cops who got it and to fire the cops who didn't. And that's what we had to do. And I realized that I shouldn't be about the business of suing LAPD, all cops all the time, that I had to learn to recognize the cops who were fighting for the right things, and I had to get behind them and help them push. But it took a good 15 years of inside work, I call it. It's an inside-outside strategy. Yes, you're pushing on the outside, but you're no longer suing. And you've moved to the inside to try to understand what cops need, work with them to make their conditions better so that they can become empowered. And the cops who believe in the Constitution, who believe in treating people fairly, you want them in charge instead of the hunter killers. You don't want the bad cops in charge.
Now, you did meet an officer who was sympathetic to where you were coming from, and you guys ended up partnering together, Charlie Beck, who's now the chief of police of the LAPD. How did that relationship start?
I think our real partnership began after Chief Bratton took over. Remember the Rampart scandal, the gangster cop scandal? And the Rampart scandal meant the ushering in of Chief Bratton, a totally outside chief who had a clear vision of constitutional policing. You may not agree with him on everything, but he had the right vision for police. And he was strong enough and had a big enough ego to enforce it. And so they placed Bratton in. Once that gangster cop scandal hit the papers, the intellectual elite in L.A. abandoned LAPD and said, okay, we're done defending these guys. They've gone too far this time. And what they did is they handed LAPD over to the federal courts. And the federal courts said, okay, you better get a transformative chief in here, and we want a consent decree to lock your behavior down. And we want to see constitutional policing before we lift the decree. And so with the help of the federal courts and Chief Bratton and police commissions who were empowered to enforce the consent decree, we began to see slowly, very slowly, those changes. And that's when I joined LAPD. I put my lawsuits away for a little while. I still had it ready to file just in case. But I did. Chief Bratton told me, lady, put your complaint away and come inside and help me change how my cops think. And I took him up on that, and I drove my Prius into the parking lot, and I parked right next to the chief. And some assistant chiefs called the tow trucks to have my car removed because they said it was a liberal car and they didn't allow liberal
cars. Get that liberal
cars.
Prius out of there.
Yeah, that's right. Get that Prius out of here. But, you know, it was a rocky start, but we had to learn slowly to walk together and then to dance together. And pretty soon, Bratton and I were like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers of police reform. He could finish my sentences. He did have the right vision, and he was tough enough to enforce it on LAPD's culture. What we were really talking about was doing a culture transplant. Right. We had to change how these cops thought and how they behaved.
Well, okay. I want to break that down. Okay. How do you change how cops think? That seems like, do you just sit down with cops and sit in their car with them and retrain them? That sounds so unrealistic to me.
Well, that's part of it, but that's not the first thing you do. Right. The first thing you have to do is you have to model what you're talking about, because they're not going to know. If you just describe conceptually what you're talking about, they're not going to get it. So what you have to do is you have to say, here's how you do this now. Here's how you pull somebody over. Here's how you prone them out on the street. Here's how we're going to do it differently. Here's how we're going to address the public differently. Here's how you talk to them now. Here's how we want you to address them. You have to tell them what they're doing now, and then you have to tell them what you want them to move to. Do you want them to change?
Give me an example. Give me just one example. Let's say something easy, like a traffic stop. What were they doing? What did you tell them you wanted them to do? Which is what they had to do, right, I would assume as well.
Right. Well, first of all, you talk to them about the thresholds. Why are you pulling anybody over? Is it just because you saw somebody black in an expensive car that you didn't think they ought to be driving? Or did they really break a rule that needed to be enforced? So it's the threshold for pulling somebody over, the grounds for pulling somebody over. Then once you've pulled them over, the attitudes with which you address them, how polite you are or impolite. I mean, they used to just speak to people in an awful tone. It was disrespectful. It was full of derision. It was very clear they were out to humiliate people. They would pull people out of their cars and throw them on the ground and prone them out for no reason. Jeez. They didn't care if you were in a business suit or in jeans. They They would prone people out for absolutely no reason. There's no reason to prone anybody out unless you're about to make an arrest. They weren't going to arrest these people. They just wanted to humiliate them. So you go over every single moment of the encounter with the public and you dissect it. And then you make them go through some practice sessions with how they're going to change their behavior. And yeah, you have to model it. You have to analyze it for them. You have to identify the problem. You have to analyze how you pick it apart and understand what they're doing currently. Then you have to show them what you want them to move to. It's painstaking and it's painful, but that's what it takes to re-engineer and reprogram your cop behavior.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was reading about your work. At one point, I think it was in an 18-month period, you interviewed personally, one-on-one, over 900 white police officers. What do they say?
It wasn't just white officers. Mm-hmm. Okay. It was all officers. It was majority white. I was trying to understand how Bratton's cops were thinking. And I wanted to understand everything from their fears and to their desires and their visions for their careers. I needed to understand what made his cops tick. And the only way I figured, well, if they think I'm representing the chief, maybe they'll talk to me because they'll think it's a way to get information back to the chief. And luckily, I was very lucky, they did take that view. And they started opening up because they wanted the chief to hear what their real thinking was. And they knew that I wouldn't tell the chief who said what. Mm-hmm. I promised them anonymity, and I kept that promise. So what happened is once they realized that Chief Bratton was listening to me, they really opened up. They just did a download of all their thoughts and all their fears. And I would hear things like, look, lady, I'm going to be honest with you. Black people scare me. I didn't grow up around black people. I grew up in Antelope Valley. We didn't have any blacks. And I don't really know how to talk to them. Or, lady, black men scare me. And I need help. I mean, I was stunned. Wow. I had to kind of keep the stunned look off of my face. And I could not be judgmental. I had to sit there and listen, and then I had to offer something helpful that told them, look, it's part of the human condition to be afraid of people you're not familiar with. It's also part of the human condition to be wary of people you've never been around. So just accept that as the human condition, and let's move on from there. Now, here are some of the coping skills. Do you want to know how you break down the fear? Well, you hang around with folks. You get to know them. You know, once you know somebody by their first name, even if it's Pookie, and even if Pookie is a gang member, you know what? Once you sit down and talk to Pookie, once you have breakfast with him every now and then, once you start hanging out with him and play basketball a couple of times a week with him, guess what? You're going to become really relaxed around him and you're not going to fear him anymore. Because really, while Pookie's a gang member, he's not really one of the bad guys. Hmm. And you can begin to make those distinctions. And surely and slowly, that's how we did it.
Did you think they were cognizant of the fact that their fear was creating a lot of the violence that was happening in L.A. from police to black men? Like, because they're afraid that's why they were quicker to pull the trigger or quicker to act the way they were?
No, I don't think they connected those dots. I think what they realized was that the level of discomfort with blacks meant they had to fix that because they knew they weren't interacting with people in a proper way. They knew that much. They felt so uncomfortable that they actually voiced that fear. And it was enough to voice that fear. And I said, well, that's what's driving your discomfort. And your discomfort is leading to misunderstandings. And the misunderstandings lead to friction, and the friction leads to problems. So they got that much. But I don't think that they connected the dots quite the way you and I would.
You know this well. You're a civil rights lawyer. But you say you were surprised, almost shocked, at how many times these men talked about being afraid of black men. Were you ready to, I mean, did you know that was the issue before you went into it? Or are you really surprised that fear was such a big issue?
I didn't think that fear would be as big of an issue. I knew that unfamiliarity was an issue. And I knew just because of my knowledge of human interaction and the tribal dynamics amongst our different tribes, I knew that the intertribal problems were stuck on stupid and that we didn't have the familiarity that we needed. I mean, I'm just talking basic familiarity so that you don't startle when a black man walks in the room, or you don't get that heightened heartbeat whenever you see black men or black people in general, because you're just so unfamiliar and you've had no interaction in the past and you don't know what to expect. And so you get scared. And that much I knew how to fix. That you fix by immersing people in familiarity. And once that starts to wash over them and they're used to being around folks and they play basketball with them and they play bidwist with them and they go to church with them on Sunday and they start singing in quartets with them and all kinds of stuff we got going. Once that stuff starts, then they relax. They relax and they realize, you know what? They may sound different from me. They definitely look different from me. But you want to know something? We got more in common now than we don't. And I'm kind of relaxed around them. And I don't have as heightened a fear. And even if I am a little bit nervous, that nervousness is not going to translate into a conflict or into any kind of confrontation that can end up with somebody hurt.
So interesting. You know, I was thinking about today I had to go to a luncheon with my daughter. She's seven. And at her school, she was singing. And they had like a turkey dinner for all the parents. And they had all the police officers from the community were serving the turkey meal with the boys from our high school, high school football team. All the boys from the football team were mostly black. Almost all the officers were white. And I was thinking about this interview before I did it, and I thought to myself, this is really important that they're serving mashed potatoes together. Like, you know, this accidentally can create, can get rid of a future problem. It's I guess it's important to do
that. That's right. You know, it's very important, and people don't understand how those little interactions can melt away a lot of the points of friction. And it's critical that people understand the implicit racism and the implicit sexism and the implicit homophobia and anti-Semitism that we all harbor. Now, when I say all, I mean that all of us are exposed to those isms. And when you're exposed to an ism, it gets internalized. And so when I started to explain the dynamics of racial thinking and the images and what impact an image can have, most people don't realize that just by flashing the picture of a black male face to anybody, and I do mean anybody, what you do is you have automatically set off a set of implicit assumptions and biases. You don't even have any control over it. It's just automatic. It's almost unconscious. And once those implicit biases get triggered, you want to know what happens? All of your reactions flow from that picture. That picture can cause you to have a heightened fear of the threat that you think is posed by the current situation you're in. And it can cause you to automatically think, oh, my God, there's a weapon. And so you pull your weapon out.
Right.
It can automatically cause you to think this situation is dangerous because a black face means danger in a lot of people's minds. We have all been conditioned to think of blackness as a threat. That now you want to know where that comes from. And I hope you don't think I'm crazy for saying this because it's true. It comes from our joint legacy of slavery. White people were taught to fear the slaves. Why? Because if you're enslaving people, they can turn on you and kill you. And so it comes from our joint history of slavery. Once you've enslaved a people, you have to fear them because they're likely to turn on you. And that's what was taught in the South. That is exactly what was taught in the South. It actually controlled where the houses were built in Mississippi, because Mississippi slavery was so brutal that there was a rule that you did not locate the slave master's house any closer than 5 miles to the slaves, because you did not want the slaves to murder you in your bed. So it all stems from slavery, like so much of our history.
Yeah.
And since we don't study that history, there's no way for us to understand its impact on us to this day.
You know, I'm curious, fast forward to today, and we've had a rash of publicly analyzed and viewed videos and I from Ferguson to Cleveland, Ohio to New York, where we see white police officers killing or shooting black men unarmed. And when you see it, you say, are those white officers racist when they do that chokehold on that guy? Are they racist? Do they need to get over the racism? Or is this something else that we would call this?
It's many other factors. It may be racism. It's certainly racialized reaction. And it may or may not translate to your definition of racism or my definition of racism. It doesn't matter. What's happening is that you have cops who are having an unreasonable reaction to the presence of a black man. And they are overreacting, and they are overutilizing force, and they are shooting at an inappropriate time. So when you have that dynamic unleashed, you gotta wind it back up and put it back in its box, because you do not want cops throwing people down, putting them in life-ending chokeholds. You don't want them shooting kids with toy guns. I mean, look at these shootings. They are absurd. On their face, they are absurd. But at the time, the cop is reacting to the fear in his head. He's not reacting to the reality in front of him.
Right, of course.
He's reacting to the fear in his head. And while the courts are going to say it's reasonable to be afraid of black people in this situation, you and I both know it isn't. And we have to work on dialing back that response. That's what we have to work on.
Yeah, I'm curious. You had a training. I don't know how long ago it was. LAPD Charlie Beck, the chief. You trained 50 officers for him, and I went to something called public trust policing. In theory, I understand what it was. You've broke it down a little bit already, getting more interaction with the community. But what does it literally mean? Do you say, hey, you have to spend this many hours coaching basketball, this many hours doing this? I mean, what is it like? How does you actually do this as training? How do you actually integrate this into their job?
Well, we start by saying you're not going to get promoted for how many arrests you make, which is a shock to cops, because that's how most cops are promoted. I told these cops, you are not in the arrest business. You are a specialized unit that is in the trust building business. I want these inner city public housing populations to look at you as their officers. I want them to look to you as the beacons for helping them solve their problems, for helping them make their community safer, and for helping their kids stay in school, for helping them get healthier, for helping them to solve the problems that seed crime. And those cops looked at me like I had really lost my wig.
I bet
thought,
they did.
They thought, when I told them you are not going to get promoted based on the number of arrests, their eyes got big. I said, in fact, if you make any arrests for minor infractions, including drug infractions that don't harm anybody else and involve no violence, you're going to get dinged for that. You're going to get demerits for that.
Wow.
I am not interested in you dragging in black teenagers for selling a little bit of marijuana. I don't care who's getting high by themselves, as long as they're not selling to youngsters. And I said, I don't care if they're doing small things. You are not to focus on that. That is not what we're about, because that destroys trust. When you throw people on the ground and slap handcuffs on them for, you know, selling a couple of hand-rolled cigarettes like Mr. Garner,
right,
that just totally destroys trust in the police. Because the community knows that that's an overreaction, that it's unfair, and who cares if somebody's rolling some cigarettes and selling them as singles? Who cares? No one. So, you know, it's a victimless crime, except for the idiots who want to smoke and give themselves cancer, but that's their choice.
And if they knew Eric Garner for years of talking to him and half communicating with him and playing basketball with his son or whatever, they would have a very different way of dealing with the fact that he shouldn't be selling the cigarettes at that moment. I would assume it'd be a conversation that nobody would ever know about.
Exactly. And you certainly wouldn't have wound up with a dead man.
Right.
You certainly would not have wound up with six cops jumping on a human being to take him down for no reason. I mean, if he's posing a danger to the community, that's their job. They're to take you down with whatever it takes, even if they have to shoot you. But he wasn't posing that kind of threat. There was no imminent threat to life or safety, and they had no reason to take him in.
Well, how do you promote the officers then that are in your 50 officers in your group? How are they promoted?
They have to demonstrate the relationships they've created with the community. And these are cops who every single day they go into that housing project and they figure out how to serve that population. They have bought 800 pairs of bifocals for the elders who couldn't afford them. They have brought in medical doctors with medical equipment in wagons to test for hypertension and diabetes. They have bought computers for the kids in school. You can't even list all the services they do. They are building trust through service. Trust through service. And by doing that, they have completely won over these populations. These are hardcore inner city public housing populations who revere these cops because these cops have bent over backwards to serve them. And by serving them, they're helping them to solve problems. And by helping them to solve problems, they're solving crime.
So crime's gone down. Crime's gone down in this neighborhood?
Crime has plummeted. A 66% reduction in property crimes, a 90% reduction in physical crimes. Do you know the Grape Street Crips no longer have their headquarters in Jordan Downs? They've been there for 70 years, but they moved out when these cops moved in. And it's incredible. With these populations, I'll tell you, I'll tell you the stat that bowled me. I had to sit down when I heard this one. There has not been a murder in Nickerson Gardens for 3 years. We used to have a body count weekly in Nickerson Gardens.
Wow.
And for there to be a 3-year period with no murders, that's like saying in a brothel there were no sex acts for 3 years. It's absolutely mind-blowing what has been achieved because these cops have now bonded with these populations so closely and the populations trust them so much that they're now picking up the phone and they're saying, you know that shooter in the alley the other night? Look at so-and-so.
Wow.
Now, they won't admit that they're snitching on people. That's what they would call it. But what they're doing is they've decided their community is much safer and they want to keep it safer and they're going to help the cops to keep it safer. And it has paid dividends I can't even tell you.
So are there other communities nearby, inner city communities, that see this and say, hey, we want this public trust policing in our community as well, LAPD, bring it here?
Yes, big time. And we don't know how to respond because to do community trust policing requires a cop to population ratio that we don't have. Number one.
You knew you were going to say
number
that.
Number two, yeah. It requires you to completely rewrite all of the assumptions of policing. Number three, it requires you to change all of the promotional criteria. And right now, Chief Beck and I are looking at the larger department and we're really puzzling, over how you take this great specialized unit and spread its wings and make it take over the whole department. We don't quite know how to do it, but we're studying it very carefully. We would really have to restructure LAPD because, you see, we've redefined the mission of LAPD and we've redefined the working conditions of the cops. They no longer sit in their cars and race from crisis to crisis. They're out of their cars. They're on their feet. They do foot patrols with gang intervention and with community members. They're talking to people. They get rewarded for creating relationships. They actually focus more on the relationships they have with public housing residents than they do on anything because it's those relationships that yield these benefits.
And anecdotally, you must converse with these officers. Is this a positive experience for them? Are they begrudgingly doing this or are they like, oh my God, I love going to work. I love helping.
Well, in the beginning, it was definitely begrudging.
Right.
It's like, what the hell do these people have me doing? They're ruining my job. And then when they started seeing the public turn around and support them and speak to them and welcome them, introduce them to their kids, these cops have gotten standing ovations from public housing populations. It's just an extraordinary turnaround.
I know, because in my mind, the only image I have of the LAPD, I grew up in Ohio, and the only image I have of the LAPD was after the Rodney King verdict. It was, I can't remember, it was a white man in a truck, and he got drug out by an African-American man, and they ran him over, and they looked for him, and the police chief I remember he had a gun in his hand and a vest on, and drug him away after he was arrested with a scowl on his face because he caught them. I remember calling him and caught this animal. And to me, that was my, and then the Rampart scandal. That's the only thing I know about LAPD. I think it's the only thing a lot of people know about LAPD. How do you proselytize the idea of what you're trying to do now outside of that image?
Show them the crime stats.
Right.
They can't argue with the statistics. When you have a 90% drop in physical batteries, when you have a 66% drop in property crime, and it goes, it keeps dropping. It's not just one semester of data. We're talking now 5 years of data,
right,
of constant double-digit drops. To the point that the homicides don't happen anymore. And I mean, it's just stunning. I cannot tell you what a turnaround it has been. And so they can't argue with those numbers. They may not like me. They may not like this. One man called it, one gang officer who doesn't like this model, he called it women's policing because it requires communing with people and talking to them and caring about their kids. And, you know, it's far more humane. And he said, that's girls policing. And I said, well, guess what? Get your skirt on because you're getting ready to do it.
You tell him that's great. I have a question. I hear you talking, and I'm like, how much more does this cost? How much more does your budget cost for your group of officers than it does for an equivalent group in somewhere else in the city?
Well, I haven't looked at that, but I have looked at the – if you think that each murder, each gang – well, if you talk about a gang murder, which has a lot of retaliation shootings that follow it, a gang murder – can cost $1 million to $17 million for each murder, depending on how many retaliation shootings follow the original murder. If you look at the number of murders that have been reduced, the number of shootings that have been reduced, and you calculate the medical costs and the rehabilitation costs, the prosecution costs, the imprisoning costs, if you count all of that up, this program has saved hundreds of millions of dollars for the city of Los Angeles. And so I haven't, if you added it up, it would be humongous. I heard one calculation that it was as much as $150 million. I haven't done the calculation myself, so I can't really vouch for that number, but one person did a back-of-the-envelope calculation and came up with that number. So I think that this program, it pays for itself so many times over. And what cops look for are the stats in how many lying in wait to shoot an officer stats have been reduced. How many cops being injured on the job have been reduced? And with this unit, it's down to zero. You can't argue.
You can't argue with the stats.
You can't argue with it.
You know, this is so positive, and thank you for being positive. And it's such a powerful story, and I've been reading about it for days. But I can imagine there are a lot of people I know who have read the grand jury transcripts of Michael Brown's death in Ferguson. They've seen the video of a 12-year-old, Tamir Rice, playing with a toy gun and being shot. They can hear Eric Garner in their head gasping, "I can't breathe." And they hear you saying you're not at war anymore, and they want to go to war. What do you say to their anger?
Oh, it's completely understandable. And to be honest, I don't begrudge it one bit. They should be angry. And they should be outraged. Now, anger and outrage feel good, and sometimes they're necessary outlets in response to an outrageous situation, which many of these shootings are. They're completely outrageous and completely unjustifiable. And if you are a relative of someone who's been murdered under these circumstances, there is nothing that can contain your rage. I understand that. I completely get that. And once you've expressed that rage, you have to ask yourself, okay, what's going to really prevent this from happening again? Well, it isn't going to be your rage. And it isn't going to be the marching, all of which I support. What's going to change it is changing how cops think and changing how they respond to everybody, but but in particular poor black people and poor Latino people and poor white people, because if you look at the stats on poor whites, they aren't much better. So here's the deal. We either get in the boat and row with these cops, or we're going to be marching forever and there are going to be unjustified shootings forever. The question is, what will change how cops behave, how they respond, and how they think? What will help them change? And that's what we have to focus on, and that's what I'm about the business of doing.